Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Welcome to all of you who've tuned in to listen. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and I've been practicing family medicine here in the Monterey Bay area for a very long time, and also am certified in functional medicine and acupuncture. So we talk about a combination of the ancient and the modern. We talk about cutting-edge science and also some of the ancient but still extremely effective therapeutic technologies that are out there from other cultures. Normally, I have a little bit of an opening, but we have a caller who's been waiting patiently. So we're going to go straight to Dennis in Capitola. And Dennis, you should be on the air. Hello.
Great. Hi, doctor.
Hi. What can I do for you today?
Well, I wear earplugs when I go to sleep. And in the morning, my sinuses are like totally blocked up. And if I blow my nose, so to speak, and try to get as much mucus out as I can, it seems to only get worse. If I snuff it up, so to speak, and spit it out, or swallow it, I guess. I was told a long time ago that if you swallow your own mucus, it tells your body that you still have mucus in the body, and it won't keep producing it. I haven't found that to be true.
I don't think that's true either.
Yeah. Okay. So my question is, I'm on lisinopril for high blood pressure.
Okay.
And so I don't really want to take antihistamine. Because I'm told that they raise your blood pressure?
Actually, that's decongestants. So you'd be okay with an antihistamine for your blood pressure. You just have to read the label very carefully. If it has an antihistamine plus a decongestant, as many of them do, it will say if you have hypertension, talk to your doctor. If you don't see that warning, you're probably okay with an antihistamine.
A straight antihistamine, no decongestant.
Exactly. Exactly. So that could work for you. Another thing that I wanted to throw out was a lot of times this congestion can be helped a lot by an old Ayurvedic technique called a neti pot. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. Yes, I tried actually, and I try just saline in a spray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just makes my nose run a whole lot over the sink, but it doesn't seem to solve the problem. Because throughout the day, I still have runny nose and,
Well, I think the first thing I would do is try some of the over-the-counter nasal steroids sprays that are out there now. And nasal steroids are actually designed not to get absorbed into your bloodstream, so they pretty much stay put in your nose. They reduce swelling, and because they do that, there's going to be a little bit of improvement in your eustachian tube, so your ears won't feel as plugged, which I think you might find very nice in the mornings. So after about a week of using a nasal steroid spray like Flonase or Beconase, these are available over the counter. I've seen them at the pharmacies. That can make a big difference, and after doing it daily, you may be able to drop back to every other day or every 3 days and continue the effect, and then you don't even have to take an oral antihistamine. My attitude is if I can use a drug topically and get to the problem, I'd rather put it on the surface of the body and rather than putting it into the bloodstream. Antihistamines have been associated with drowsiness. They can interact with other medications, sometimes impairing people's ability to drive or increasing their risk of an accident. So you don't necessarily want to take an antihistamine unless you have to. And then if you do take one, the best ones to take are the fexofenadine, that's the Allegra, and the Claritin. So Claritin and Allegra are both available. I think Claritin's over the counter and Allegra is still prescription, but they are really excellent agents and don't cause a lot of drowsiness. So if the spray doesn't work, that'd be your second line.
Okay, one of the reasons I'm calling today, rather than calling 3 weeks ago or a month ago, I just had symptoms of what I thought was kind of like the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took some, what do you call it, the stuff you, Alka-Seltzer Plus.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like I have phlegm down in my lungs.
Well, you know, after flu, it sounds to me like you probably have low-grade baseline allergies, and that's your chronic problem. Maybe to dust mites, which are in your bedding, so the symptoms are worse at night. Do you tend to be real stuffed up in the morning? And then you got something else on top of it that was an irritant, possibly a virus, possibly flu, but a virus that irritated the mucosa further. So you can think of it as a kind of doubling down, an amplifier for your allergy symptoms. Now you're going to have viral plus allergy symptoms, so you'll be that much stuffier. And of course, the viruses, they love respiratory epithelium from the top of the nostril to the bottom of the lung, and they can invade the cells of that entire respiratory tree and cause bronchorrhea, which is basically runny lungs, just along with the runny nose that you've been suffering from all along. So watch the color of the phlegm. Watch for a fever.
Yellow.
Yeah. First thing in the morning, I don't care about, but if you're bringing up a lot of yellow phlegm and it's darker than a yellow sticky note, then you may want to go see your doctor and get listened to, because you could have a secondary bacterial bronchitis more likely, but even a secondary bacterial pneumonia is possible. And we're in the season where that happens. And I saw a case today, actually, of exactly that earlier today, where I sent the patient for an x-ray, and lo and behold, he has a secondary pneumonia from his influenza. And those can be very dangerous, need to be treated with antibiotics. So you don't want to mess around with that stuff.
Okay. Is there a time limit? Like, if it's going away, would that be indicative of its problem solved?
Hey, dude, if it's going away, you're winning the war. Just keep getting rest and sit tight. Watch for the fever. You spike a fever, then you have to rethink it.
I haven't really spiked it. It got to 99 one.
Yeah, we're talking 101, 102 here.
Oh, no, nowhere near that.
Yeah, so you get that, you got to worry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow, that was really informative.
Well, I live to serve, so you have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
But I have a story that I wanted to put out there. You'll hear me complain about our medical record system in the United States often enough. So I'm going to just start by saying that the people of Denmark have a really lovely medical record system. It allows them to do excellent science. And a recent study showed that proton pump inhibitors, that's your omeprazole, your Prilosec, all of the little purple pill, are associated with an increased stroke risk. And the only reason they found this is because proton pump inhibitors, which is the class of drug we're talking about, these are acid-blocking agents. There's two kinds. There's the proton pump inhibitors, which are stronger, and the H2 blockers, like Tagamet, which are weaker. Anyway, these stronger ones, the Prilosecs of the world, the proton pump inhibitors, are prescription in Denmark. So anyone who takes one of those drugs is on a prescription, and it's tracked by the electronic medical record system of the Danes. Anyone who gets a stroke, because they have an integrated system, is likewise tracked. So they were able to look at the stroke risk and proton pump inhibitor use, and what they found was pretty substantial. The unadjusted incidence, which means just the raw data, showed that there were 55 strokes per 10,000 person years in non-users and 89 strokes per 10,000 years in proton pump users. But we have this thing called comorbidity. So it could be that the older you are, the more alcohol you use, for example, the more aspirin you take, would be an influence on how much proton pump inhibitor that you use. So when they controlled for every single thing there was, they still saw a substantial increase in the risk of strokes, particularly for the higher doses. And the fact that this was dose-dependent, the lower doses not having a stroke risk, and the highest doses having a definite stroke risk, is, again, a sort of secondary indicator that this isn't just a fluke or a coincidence, but real data. So what we want to do with this information is, if you are taking a proton pump inhibitor and have any kind of elevated cholesterol or hypertension, you might want to think of switching to ranitidine or cimetidine, and seeing if that will control your symptoms. This is particularly true if you're taking it because of discomfort from, say, heartburn, rather than because your doctor has diagnosed an ulcer and told you you have to take this medication. Interestingly enough, this study is one of a number that came out from Denmark showing exactly how powerful it is to have a distributed database. So if you have questions, give me a call, 479-1080. So another recent bit of information that came out of a study in Denmark, again linking population-based data and raising some interesting connections, is a link with of rosacea with GI disorders. Now, I see, as a functional medicine person who's aware of the connection between rosacea as a manifestation of food sensitivity, it doesn't surprise me at all that people with injuries to their intestines are going to have more food sensitivity. That's a no-brainer for me. But if you ask a dermatologist, most American Western-trained dermatologists will deny that there's any connection between food and rosacea. And so this is one of those places where looking at the same data, functional medicine and allopathic medicine completely disagree. This Danish data shows a distinct connection between anyone with celiac disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, or irritable bowel syndrome, but not people with Helicobacter pylori or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which are two other gastrointestinal syndromes. So what do I think is going on here? I think that there's damage to the intestinal wall when you have Crohn's disease, or celiac disease. This is an inflammatory autoimmune attack. It's as if your immune system was treating the bowel wall as a foreign body, as a bacteria, and attacking it. Well, that's going to interfere with one of the most important functions of the intestinal wall, which is keeping the bad guys and the large molecules in the intestine and out of the subintestinal tissues, where the immune system is just sitting there waiting to pounce on anything that comes through. Think of, I think that's a good metaphor, might be the Immigration Service after a presidential executive order excluding people from certain countries. Well, suddenly that Immigration Service has to be very careful, and they're on high alert, not trying to let nothing get through. Now imagine someone opened the doors wide and let everyone come through. Well, that's what happens when you have a leaky gut. The immune system then starts grabbing antigens randomly, even harmless food antigens, and giving them the third degree, making antibodies against them, and we develop food sensitivities. Subsequently, when you eat the foods that you are sensitive to, little bits of molecules of the food are actually able to get through the intestinal wall. And in that circumstance, the immune system grabs onto them, which is good. Except that now you've got this particle of activated immune system and antigen that your body has to deal with. And one of the places these particles can go and do is the skin, where they send an inflammatory reaction. So that's the story about leaky gut and how anything that causes leaky gut can trigger skin diseases like rosacea, and it can also trigger things like joint symptoms and, in some cases, in some unfortunate people, it can even trigger central nervous system issues like brain fog, and those are really difficult to tease out and understand. So our first one here is from Dan in Salinas. Dan writes about ketamine for treating peripheral neuropathy. Hello, I'm 63-year-old living in Salinas, and I was recently diagnosed with low-grade lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I have very severe peripheral neuropathy in my feet. I was a very active person, but now I can barely walk 10 feet without severe pain, burning, pressure, numbness, and the sensation of 1,000 bee stings. I'm taking gabapentin and tramadol, but with very little relief. my oncologist has not heard of ketamine infusion, which I was reading can help with neuropathic pain. Is this something that might work for me? Well, Dan, I'm going to send you two links, one to a review article looking at ketamine infusion for peripheral neuropathy. And to answer your question, yes, IV ketamine has been shown to be very helpful. It is thought to act centrally in the brain on something called the N, as in Nancy, MDA receptor. This is the receptor that uses glutamate as a neurotransmitter, and in some people, these are people who can't tolerate aspartame or NutraSweet. It's because it interferes with their NMDA receptors. Now, in this case, when you have a chronic pain like peripheral neuropathy, downregulating those receptors can make a very big difference. And it does work IV. The problem is intravenous infusion doesn't last very long, just a couple of days. So I'm also sending you a line about a person, another article about topical use of this agent, and it has the doses in this article. So I'll send those to your email. You might want to try having a compounding pharmacy. You do have one in Salinas. Make that up with you. You'll need a doctor's prescription, but I bet your oncologist won't object to giving you something topical. So that might be something to give a try. And we're going now to a caller, and that is Liz from Santa Cruz. Hello, Liz. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Dr. John. I'm calling because I am thinking about having surgery for uterine fibroids to remove them. And I recently saw an energy healer, and I actually felt some results and a shrinkage. And I'm wondering if you have some ideas on that. I, like anyone, am a little nervous about having surgery.
Okay. Let me start by asking you, Liz, are you finished with your childbearing?
I am.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking that is because the simpler surgery is probably a hysterectomy and leaving the cervix. So it's called a partial hysterectomy. And unless you've had a history of cervical cancer, you want to leave that cervix because the cervix itself is there as a support structure, and there's a number of, like a trampoline sort of, that pelvic floor, and there's a number,
all right.
And you don't want your bladder dropping. So if you take the cervix, you've got a big chance of your bladder dropping, plus at least a third of women who lose the cervix also lose their orgasms. And that,
oh, no.
Well, that's a big price to pay. So you can,
very.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't want to do that. So a partial hysterectomy might be better. The question is, why are we doing the hysterectomy, or why are we doing removing the fibroids? And there's only two reasons to take out fibroids, because after menopause, they're going to shrink. And if you have bad pain and you're cramping and your quality of life is poor, or you have anemia because you're bleeding heavily, those are the reasons to remove the fibroids. Sometimes people can just, you know, learn to make their peace with their fibroids and just kind of hold out until menopause. And as I say, a lot of times, if they're mildly symptomatic, not severely symptomatic, a little menopause is all it takes.
Well, here's my deal, Dr. Dawn. I'm 70 years old. I've had them for 20 years. I'm not bleeding, that's for sure. I don't know what my estrogen level is, but... Mm-hmm.
Well, are you in pain?
Well, I wasn't until I took up outrigging, and then I kind of seems like I pushed everything back, and so now I'm having pain if I walk more than 2 miles.
Okay, and that'd be a reason, I guess, if you plan on continuing to do the walking. As I said, the conservative therapy would be good, and you said the energy healer seemed to help, and since you weren't hurting before, and you've been walking around with these things, it's possible that you might have jogged things around a bit down there and gotten some inflammation, and maybe you can reduce the inflammation. I would also say, you know, I don't know what kind of energy healer you saw. I will just say about energy healing that our electromagnetic fields extend out about 4 to 6 feet from our body surface, and that's with the instruments that we can connect, that we can use scientifically to detect them. So you have an EMF around your body, and we can watch that EMF and someone else's EMF actually interact. So when people say, well, I'm doing energy healing, I don't immediately roll my eyes and dismiss it, because there is at least a plausibility that some people might be able to actually consciously or somehow modulate their energy field in a way that it could have an effect on the person that's near them. And that's physics. You know, I don't know that you can do it over a telephone line. That's getting a little far-fetched for me. But right there, right up close and personal, yes. And of course, in acupuncture, which I do, we have a whole protocol for shrinking fibroids. And I've seen it work. So I believe that these things can do what they taught me in medical school they don't do, which is shrink. I guess it's not spontaneous, because we're doing a therapy to get that to happen. But nevertheless, I would strongly encourage you to try those alternative treatments first, because your symptoms are mild. And if you can address them with a once-a-month acupuncture treatment or a once-a-month energy treatment, really all you need to do is fix the inflammation. You don't necessarily need to shrink the fibroids.
Okay, so then my second question is, if I'm 70 years old and way past menopause, why haven't they shrunk? Because that's what all the alternative healers have told me.
Because they don't, well, maybe they shrank a little, but they didn't shrink enough. You know, I don't expect them to go completely away. They rarely involute totally. They're sort of like, you know, your breasts didn't disappear either, right? But they did kind of shrink.
Okay, all right.
Okay, anything else, Liz?
No, I think that's very wonderful. Thanks so much for being on the air again. I missed you, and I'm so happy that you and Jackie were able to make this collaboration.
Me too. Jackie has been wonderfully generous in letting me do this, and I hope to be here on KSCO for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks again. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And we're going to go to Karen. Hello, Karen.
Hi, Dr. Don.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I have a question in regards to my mother. She's age 92 and is on levothyroxine for her thyroid. And the doctor has told her to start taking Prilosec for an irritated stomach. So I was trying to find out if the two could be taken together, since both need to be taken on an empty stomach. And I have conflicting research when I go online to look at it. Some says it's okay, and others says that the levothyroxine needs an acidic stomach to work to its full potential, and Prilosec reduces that, and so they should never be taken together. So I'm trying to find a reliable source to know what to do.
Gotcha. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that we have really good data on thyroid. The stuff gets deactivated by everything. Okay, just about anything in the stomach besides water will interfere with the absorption of thyroid medication. So that's, you know, you can't mix them. A good time maybe to take you said it was a proton pump inhibitor, right? The second drug?
Yeah, Prilosec.
Prilosec. Mm-hmm. And that one actually, I know it says it needs to be taken on an empty stomach. You could consider taking it at bedtime if she's not taking any other medications there. But Prilosec will play well with other drugs. So if she's taking nighttime medications, she could take that with Prilosec. And it wouldn't have any, it wouldn't interfere.
So how long after dinner can you take Prilosec? So it's effective.
You know, I've had people take it with dinner and have it do well. So I don't think that you really have to adhere to that rule that strictly. But most people will empty their stomach in 90 minutes. If you're older, maybe it's going to take her 2 hours. So 2 hours at the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where dinner time and bedtime is. But in the elderly, I generally recommend at least two. In everybody, I generally recommend at least 2 hours. Because if you make a habit of going to bed with a full stomach, you're going to end up damaging your esophagus. Sooner or later, you're going to end up with reflux.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
You are very welcome, and thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. So we're going now to Carla in Soquel. Hello, Carla.
Hi.
Hi.
Dr. John.
Welcome.
I'm calling you. Thank you so much. I'm calling you about I have had an episode over Labor Day and was hospitalized, and they found out I had an enlarged spleen, which later they determined that I did have a small infarction. I had all the tests, every test. I had genetic testing, seeing a hematologist because they were just sure I had some kind of cancer. And it turns out I just was low in iron, low in B12, and had iron infusions, B12 injections. And then for me, I said, well, I have an absorption problem. And so I started taking some supplements and gluten-free and just trying to work on my gut for that. But I did go see a surgeon on Tuesday in Stanford, and he said that, you know, I'm not a candidate for surgery, and he looked at all my tests and couldn't really see why I had the enlarged spleen, but my spleen is enlarged 3 times what it should be. And he said he's never seen any course of nutrition or anything like that ever shrink a spleen.
You know, the reasons that spleens enlarge are various. I mean, some mononucleosis, for example, I'm sure they checked you for that. There, I don't know if they checked you for babesiosis. That's a tick-borne illness that in this area is not that hard to get. If we've got plenty of ticks out there. An infectious disease workup, did you have that?
I don't know that they, I know that they checked me for all the hepatitis B's and C's. I've had CAT scans.
Okay.
CAT scans. I've had genetic testing.
You mentioned that. I'm going to give you a couple of things that you could ask. Somebody to look in your records. I'm sure you've got a stack that's an inch thick at this point.
Yes.
But somewhere in there, you should be able to find something called a babesiosis titer, and that's BABESIOSIS.
Okay.
I would be a little surprised that they didn't check for that, along with checking you for the other infections that can cause spleen enlargement. But because it's a tick-borne illness, you know, it might have slipped through, and it's totally appropriate that you had a hematology workup, and that's where most of these come from. But there is certainly some other what we call idiopathic causes, which is we're idiots and we can't figure out the pathology. I'm assuming that you weren't taking any vasoconstrictors like migraine.
No, I've never
migraine
been
drugs.
Ill before.
Okay.
No.
How old are you?
I'm 65.
Okay, and
well, I'm gonna be 65.
Was there any trauma involved at all?
No.
Very,
no.
Very, very, very unusual. And I don't have a
yeah,
good.
Yeah, they both. I mean, the Stanford doctor and then my hematologist. They both say it's very mysterious.
So,
you know, but I have been able to control pain when I've had pain since the initial episode by going to acupuncture. And then recently, my son got me some CBD oil.
You were saying that somebody had given you some CBD oil.
Yeah, my son did. And okay. I've just taken it a couple times when I've had like some twinging, like sometimes if I have a deep breath, take a deep breath, I can feel it in my spleen, and the CBD oil helps. Definitely the acupuncture helps, but I'm a little just concerned when somebody tells you that it can't be, shrunken, you know, like, so what's the inflammation, what,
Exactly.
You know, what else can I do?
Well, I think stay with the acupuncture, because there you might actually get some shrinkage with that as well. The spleen is like a giant sponge, and enlarged spleen is basically a blood-congested sponge. So, and I did mention the babesiosis. I think that you could probably get the spleen removed, but that makes you more vulnerable to certain kinds of infections. And it's a surgical risk. So I wouldn't do that if your symptoms can be controlled. The main things that you have to watch out for are trauma. And so things like car accidents. So you want to be very careful with where you place your seat belts and making sure that it's really low on your hips so that it's not going to accidentally squeeze your spleen in a car accident. And,
okay.
And I think when I'm a passenger in a car, I would keep myself I'd pull that seat as far back as I could if there's a passenger airbag, which there mostly is, because in a collision, obviously, if you're the driver, you want the airbag because you don't want to hit the steering wheel. On the other hand, if you're a passenger, what you'd rather be is you'd rather have the airbag inflate and bounce off of that rather than have the airbag hit you. So being that much further back is actually good from the standpoint of reducing the chance of trauma to the spleen.
Okay.
So with enlarged spleen, your big risk is a rupture, and that's the thing we don't want to see happen to you.
Yes, because he also said, you know, if you remove the spleen, and it will have no effect on this, low iron, low B12. And I would still be dealing with that.
Well, you'd still be dealing with the low B12, and if your iron is low, you may have an absorption problem. And it's possible that you would do better with iron supplements taken at the same time, and you need to supplement vitamin C. So you want rose hips vitamin C, because it turns out some people, the regular vitamin C doesn't work for them, and they need this rose hips vitamin C. And if they don't have the arceola, the vitamin C, which is the complete molecule, then they can't absorb iron. So that might be the problem there, and you should certainly go get some rose hips vitamin C and start taking it. And watch your iron levels, see if they come up in combination with that. As far as the B12 is concerned, that will generally respond to supplementation. And you can do that by injection, or you can do that by under-the-tongue B12. And that will work for most people. So you could give those things a try.
I have had the iron infusion and the B12 injections, and my numbers have come up, but they, are still need to come up some more.
Right. And you're at risk for you're at risk for anemia, you're at risk for low platelets, because the spleen is a filter. And if you've got too much filtering going on, you may pull blood products out of the bloodstream before their time. So So they're going to be monitoring you for that. And ultimately, if you aren't able to handle it with supplementation, that all by itself is an indication to have the spleen removed. In general, splenic infarcts themselves are, let's put it this way, they're not that dangerous in and of themselves, because ultimately what happens, and we have people with sickle cell disease who have showed us this, because they have plenty of splenic infarcts as they have their sickle cell crises, and eventually the spleen just kind of shrinks away to nothing. So, but it does. I don't think you're going to have another infarct. I think that was probably a fluke. But if you do, in a way, it could almost solve the problem for you over time.
So. Yeah, well, sure, it's painful.
Oh, yes. And it's also, not really something we want to put you through. So, see what can do with support. And, you've always got the backups, the surgery in your back pocket. You could get somebody to do that.
Is there a tincture I could take?
I'm not aware of one that I would specifically, I don't have any knowledge of anything that would shrink the spleen.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to Brandy. And hello, Brandy. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. My first time calling.
Oh, well, I'm glad to meet you, Brandy. Thanks for calling.
I have, three questions for you.
All right.
Number one, what do you think about using silver?
Colloidal silver, you mean?
Yes.
I think it's a very, very effective antibacterial and antiviral. I use it a lot, have people squirt it in their nose, use it on cuts. I'm a little nervous about people swallowing large quantities of it because I think it messes up your microbiome. And if you're, I don't know if you're a first-time listener, but the microbiome, those bugs inside your gut, they're your friends. If you've got a good team of bacteria in there, they protect you from a whole lot of diseases. And they help you and they provide nutrients to you. And they help make vitamin K, for example, which otherwise you don't make. So you need those bugs, but you want a good team. And if you take, imagine you have a beautiful garden and you take, a big backpack sprayer and you throw Roundup on that whole garden and then you stand back. Well, what's going to come back first is the weeds, and you'll end up with thistle, and you'll end up with dandelions, and you'll end up with crabgrass. But that beautiful garden is not going to come back spontaneously. You're going to have to replant that guy. So you could think of your intestines as a garden. If you throw silver in there, it's just like throwing Roundup on that garden. You're going to kill off all the good guys as well as the bad guys. So I'm a little nervous about using silver, you know, orally, but if you think about it as being a strong antibiotic, then you see what I'm talking about. What sort of specific silver utilization are you thinking about?
Well, I have used it quite a bit for nasal infections and throat infections, sore throats.
Mm-hmm. I think it works for both
like
of those.
That.
Yep. What was your next question, Brandy?
Also, with that last question, could you use probiotics and bring back your garden?
Yeah, but it's kind of tricky, and nobody's done enough research to really give us a good how-to guide. So it's a lot of seat-of-the-pants restoration. What we hope for is that we give these probiotics that you can buy, which is maybe 5% of the variety not even 5% of the variety that actually exists. Because, you see, most of the bugs in there in your intestines, they're actually poisoned by oxygen. They're what we call anaerobic. And the bacteria that you take that are probiotics, those are aerobic bacteria for the most part, because we have to grow them in vats and factories. We can't figure out how to grow bacteria and not expose them to air. That's kind of difficult. So as a result, we don't have the kind that's the majority in our gut. But what we discover is that if you give these aerobic bacteria that are the protective ones, they seem to build up an environment that grabs the dirt that comes through your mouth from just, you know, breathing in dust and breathing in and eating food that, you know, has a little bit of soil on it. And so you do replace those anaerobic bacteria. Plus, if you've got an appendix, you're ahead of the game, because those bacteria hide out in the appendix. And even when you take antibiotics, you don't kill all of the ones inside the appendix. So they're a little safer there. So you have a kind of a seed bank, if you will, in the appendix that helps out with the restoration.
It's interesting. My second question was, I've heard Dr. Wallach come on the radio and say that antihistamine can cause Alzheimer's or dementia?
Yeah, I say that too. And when we say cause, that's a tricky word, because there's an association, and what we say is association doesn't equal causality. So there's a linkage, however. If you look at people who have had, like in this Denmark research that I was talking about, I think this one came out of Denmark as well a few years ago, is that they looked at who got prescriptions for antihistamines, and then they looked at Alzheimer's rates, and what they saw was that antihistamine prescriptions were you had a higher risk if you were taking antihistamines of being diagnosed with Alzheimer's. But the problem with that is that when people have early Alzheimer's, their sleep gets screwed up. And then people will take antihistamines as a sleeping pill because they make you drowsy. So is the Alzheimer's causing the prescription of the antihistamines, or are the antihistamines somehow impairing the brain over time? And the answer to that is, we don't know. We've got a clear statistical association, but we don't know the direction that the causal loop is moving. And believe me, this is an area of very, very strict inquiry in the Alzheimer's field, because people want to nail this down and figure out if they need to be giving people a precaution. But at the moment, we don't have firm evidence, so I go precautionary. Yeah, don't use antihistamines, particularly the old kind that get into the brain. I had mentioned Allegra and Claritin, because those are large molecules. They don't cross a normal blood-brain barrier, so that's a better solution.
What about Allertec?
I don't know. What's the chemical name for Allertec?
It's a... God, I can't even pronounce it here. Serzin hydrochloride tablets?
Yeah, that would be one that did cross the blood-brain barrier, so that'd be one I would steer away from.
Do you know of a dosage that would be safe?
Nope. I mean, I don't know that there is actually a risk, and I definitely don't have any dose data. We just have an association, and it's a solid association, but we don't know what it means.
I got allergies, and this is one of the few things that really helped me out.
What about the nasal steroids?
I haven't tried those because I haven't been told.
Listen, they're over the counter now, so they're easy to get. So try the nasal steroids, and I'm going to give you another tip. There's a particular probiotic that reduces allergy symptoms all by itself. It sends a signal to the part of the immune system that does allergies, and it down-regulates it. And that's solid scientific evidence. There may be other probiotics that do this, but this one's been shown to do it in humans. And I always like data in humans. It's called Lactobacillus rhamnosus. So that's Lactobacillus L-A-C-T-O-B-A-C-I-L-L-U-S, and then rhamnosus is R-H-A-M-N-O-S-U-S. So that one, about 10 billion organisms, is the dose in scientific studies that reduced allergy symptoms. And then I've got one more herbal tip for you, and that is quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. That's a bioflavonoid. In other words, it's a plant molecule. It's found in apple skin. It's found in a bunch of other fruits and vegetables. And you need about 1,000 milligrams of this stuff twice a day to get any kind of impact on allergies. But you can take up to 3 times a day of 1,000 milligrams. It's very safe. It's the old an apple a day keeps the doctor away, except you're using a concentrated version. But that too has good solid scientific data that it reduces allergy symptoms. So try to use these natural agents and see if you can get off and see if you can end the steroid stuff, because I really don't think that's dangerous, you know, and I would tell you if I did. But that combination will probably do the trick for you, and you can stay away from the antihistamines, which is what I'm advising everybody to do until we've exonerated them or solidly implicated them. You know, why take a chance if you can find something else?
Right. One last question.
Sure.
Is there any facility, is there any medical places that the homeless people can go for help?
Well, it depends on your flavor of poverty, basically. If you can manage to qualify for Medi-Cal, then absolutely. There are Medi-Cal clinics that people can go to. There are a few free clinics. There's a free clinic sponsored by Dominican Hospital called RotaCare. It's a collaboration between the Rotary Club and the Dominican Hospital, and I know they still exist. I think if you call Dominican Hospital, you could probably get some information about where they see people. There's a few underground free clinics around, but I don't have I just know they exist, but I don't have anything I can tell you, and I don't know what's out there in Monterey. So here's this. If anybody within the sound of my voice knows of a source of health care for the homeless besides the emergency room, which is a lousy place to go for health care unless you're really, really sick, and then it's excellent, please write to us at AskDrDawn.com, and I will put that information out next month. And keep putting it out every time I do the program, because I believe that we need to look after each other more than ever now, as we're about to see another major crazy overhaul of the healthcare system. I got to let you go now, Randy, but thank you for a very important question.
Thank you, and you've been very informative. I really appreciate it.
Well, you just keep listening.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.